Been joined on the line this afternoon by the editor of the Cricketer's Bible, the Wisdom Cricketer's Almanac 2016. It's a very good afternoon to Lawrence Booth. Good afternoon, Lawrence.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Yes, well, the cricket season, I will say, is in full flow. You can tell it is because it's freezing cold. I'm sitting at the Oval at the moment, and I was going to say... Yeah, absolutely. At least I'm not outside. I'm in a press box at the moment, which at least is quite warm, actually. But there's a few people dotted around here, Lawrence, and believe you me, it's very, very cold outside. But at least they can warm themselves by looking at Wisdom 2016, a fascinating book as ever. Let's just quickly run through the five players that were nominated and announced as Wisdom Cricketers of the Year. Just have your thoughts on these five, please, if that's okay, Lawrence. Johnny Bairstow, Brendan McCullum, Steve Smith, Ben Stokes and Kane Williamson.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of English guys in there, which is always nice. Johnny Bairstow had a cracking season with Yorkshire, scored 500s in the county championship as they retained the title and was the top of the English first class averages at the end of the season. Also played a very important one day knock for England in the deciding one day against New Zealand, 83 not out, 60 balls at Chestnut Street, which that was a series that really lifted English spirits. Ben Stokes, kind of, his statistics weren't necessarily the best last summer, but he seemed to be at the centre of all the uplifting things that happened in English cricket. He was the guy who really got the crowd going at Lords against New Zealand in that test match at the start of the year, where you felt that the public was reconnecting with the England team. It had been a bad 12 months for English cricket in that sense, and then Stokes got them going, an 85 ball 100 in the second innings to follow up from a 92 in the first, and then found himself on a hat-trick on the final day when he got rid of Williamson and McCullum to other cricketers of the year in successive balls. So I think he very much deserved his place. The two Kiwis certainly did. I think Williamson was the wicket that England wanted. Every time he came out to bat, he had this remarkable sense of serenity and calmness about him, and until he was out of the way, England could never feel secure about knocking New Zealand over. McCullum was an interesting one. He didn't necessarily score the runs he would have liked. I think his top score in 10 international innings last summer was 55, but it was the manner in which he led that New Zealand team with a smile on their face, an attacking brand that probably brought the best out of England. That first morning at Lords, when they were England were 30 before, and Stokes and Root were obliged to counter-attack because McCullum had set such attacking fields, and that sort of fed into the way the whole summer took place. And it finished with a visit of Australia, and that brings us on to Steve Smith, who was I'm not going to say the fifth or the final one, because it doesn't work like that, but he was certainly one of the five. And though he finished on the losing side and perhaps didn't score the runs he would have liked in the test at Trent Bridge at Edgbaston, which decided the series, he scored a brilliant double 100 at Lords and an equally impressive 140-odd at the Oval in games that Australia won, and he finished the Ashes as the leading run scorer on either side.
Yes, you mentioned about these New Zealanders, as you say, Kane Williamson and the excellent Brendan McCullum. And not only did Kane Williamson the leading cricketer in the world, but we also got the leading women cricketer in the world as well. And believe it or not, she's New Zealander as well, Susie Bates.
Yeah, that's right. It's all a bit of a clean sweep for the Kiwis.
It is, isn't it?
They've never had more than one cricketer of the year within the five, so this is a first for them to have both McCullum and Williamson. And yes, Susie Bates was well-deserving winner of our second annual leading woman cricket in the world award, the first one by Meg Lanning of Australia, the Australian captain. And I think, probably most people looking at women's cricket would have thought that maybe Lanning or Elise Perry, her teammate, would have been at the front of the pack to win that award. But Bates had an excellent year. She averaged over 50 against Sri Lanka. She scored a terrific 100 against England early in the year to help New Zealand win that series. And she bowled a bit as well, so she had a great all-round year. And I thought, really, that New Zealand had a great chance of winning the World T20 recently in India. It was a surprise when they lost to West Indies in the semi-finals. But Bates was at the heart of all the good things that they did.
You mentioned that T20. Did it surprise you, Lawrence, how well England did?
Well, yes and no. I mean, 2020, as we all know, is a bit more of a lottery than other forms of the game. But, the way their white ball cricket have been progressing since the debacle of the 50-over World Cup a year earlier in Australia and New Zealand meant that they're always in with a chance. I probably felt they had a 50-50 chance of getting out of the group stage. And once they did that, they seemed to sort of gather a bit of momentum. I know they lost in the final eventually, but really they were only one decent over away from lifting the trophy. And if you'd said that to England cricket fans a year earlier, when they were being knocked out of the World Cup by Bangladesh, they'd have laughed at you. So quite heartening that they carried on playing the style that helped them progress over the previous 12 months, and very promising for the future.
You mentioned in Wisdom about England and the ECB, a bold new approach. I think a lot of cricket fans are really enjoying this bold new approach from England now, with their attacking options that they have.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it happened quite quickly after they got rid of Peter Moores as coach in May last year. Paul Farbrace came in as the interim coach before Trevor Bayliss was appointed in time for the Ashes. And he was determined to give the players a certain amount of freedom to go out and express themselves, really. We'd all seen over the previous couple of summers that there are some very keen strikers of the ball in county cricket, and perhaps those guys weren't getting the chance they deserved in the England team. Well, Farbrace did precisely that. The results were there for all to see in the first one, the international that he took charge of at Edgbaston, when England got 489 against New Zealand, and it just held the world away from the kind of scratching, scraping one-day stuff that we'd seen at the 50-over World Cup. So I think they deserve a lot of credit, England. But Andrew Strauss also stuck with Owen Morgan, who frankly had been given a bit of a hospital pass taking over in time for the World Cup, but with only a tri-series in Australia to prepare for it, because Alistair Cook had only just been sacked. So that was a total mess. But England very quickly emerged from it, and now they're among the more exciting teams to watch in the global game.
There's a big debate going on about Test cricket. Should we have day-night Test cricket? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think we should. I think it's certainly worth a try. I write a bit about this in the editor's notes in Wisdom this year. We all saw what an impact it had at Adelaide in November when Australia hosted New Zealand for the first day-night pink ball test. We got 123,000 people through the gates in the 3 days that the game took place on. And it caused a real stir. And usually that game, Australia hosting New Zealand, would have got a fraction of that crowd. You know, the crowds even in Australia tend to turn up for the Ashes and perhaps for India, but not for much else. So I think it's got to be worth a try. You know, the administrators tell us all the time that Test cricket remains the most important form of the game, but the evidence suggests that a lot of them are throwing their eggs in the 2020 basket, which is fine, but let's at least try something to get a different demographic into Test cricket. And I think day-night cricket can work in places other than Australia. I think it could even work in England at the height of summer, when England are hosting teams that don't necessarily draw the crowds in a way that Australia or India do. You know, we've got Sri Lanka and Pakistan this year, for example. I know that outside London, ticket sales have been sluggish so far. So it's got to be worth a try. Cricket can be a bit fussy at times, and it looks for reasons for things not to happen. But I think that day-night test in Adelaide was one very good argument for it to be experimented with in the future.
Brilliant. Lawrence, as always, thank you very much once again for talking to us. Just give us a quick idea where people can purchase the excellent Wisdom.
Gosh, well, it should be on sale in all good bookshops. I know Waterstones has been pushing it hard. It's on Amazon, of course.